It was 50 years ago, on November 22, 1963, that our president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, was assassinated. So why are we talking about this on a magic podcast? Well, believe it or not, there is some sort of a magic connection between the two. And so I'm going to let our good friend Walter Zany Blaney explain it all to you now. So, Walter, you and I have talked many times in the past about this very interesting type of relationship or something, I guess, that magic has to the assassination of JFK back in 63. And as we're approaching the 50th anniversary of his assassination, there's a lot of stuff that's going on the news around the U.S., a lot of documentaries and everything about conspiracy theories and everything else. And so, you have an interesting story, I think, to tell. Could you give me a little bit more details?
Well, yeah, sure. The way it's connected with magic is that it entails a longtime good friend, Tom Palmer. And Tom Palmer lived in Dallas, where I lived. And
Tom was also known as Tony Andruzzi, wasn't he?
Yeah, later on in life, he gave up on this regular kind of funny magic and everything and became Tony Andruzzi and went into...
more the bizarre, magic. Yeah, the bizarre kind of stuff. And but he was also married then to Gloria Markham. Well, let me rephrase that. I guess he was married to Gloria before she married Ralph Markham.
Yeah, that's right. And Ralph Markham was later a good friend, and Gloria also was a good friend. But anyway, Tom and Gloria were a good couple and real good friends with me, and we talked magic all the time, and he was quite an inventor himself. And a creator, and he used to enjoy creating new acts for the TAUM conventions. And every year he had a different one, and he loved to win an award and so on. But that's another story. But in this case, he had this funny act where everything went wrong. And from that, Johnny Thompson picked up on that and then got permission from Tom that he had an idea to do a similar act. Could he use the idea? And Tom said, sure, because Tom never really parlayed it into something big. He just never could focus on one thing. He always had to go on to a new act. But he did have a good idea for his act, and it was very funny, and he had this haughty, extreme super magician that knew everything about everything, and everything kept going wrong, and he would recover, and things would still go wrong, and it was like, well, that's beneath me to even notice. And he had this great thing, and you just love the act, but he never quite saw that it could take him to the heights of, say, Ballantyne, who did a similar thing, you know.
Right.
But anyway, he became the American Guild of Variety Artists. That was our Variety Artists Union, our AGVA it was called, and he became the AGVA, or what we call AGVA, representative, the union representative in Dallas. He got the job from another magician, another good friend, Al Sharp. And Al Sharp was the union representative in Dallas. And then he was good at it, and he moved up to St. Louis, which was a bigger city with a bigger clientele, I guess you'd say, or bigger membership. Mm-hmm. And then moved on up to Chicago, which was the largest in the country. And he was now the Chicago AGVA representative and just had a big membership up there. That was the center of the variety arts business, really, in our country, more so than New York or L.A.
Now, that would have been about what year? Probably back in the 1950s?
Well, back in the
40s?
60s.
Oh, 60s.
Well, yeah, in the 60s. Probably he became the AGVA representative. That change was made somewhere in the late 50s. Or maybe 1960 or so. It would be a little before 1960, probably 1958 maybe. So anyway, he was Tom's job was beholden to Al Sharp, who got it for him.
Yeah.
So he had to kind of do whatever Al ever said. But anyway, things were going along, and then the terrible assassination. In fact, the street behind our home in Dallas back then, when I was married to Joyce, we took our daughters, we just had two daughters then, and walked across the vacant lot and stood on the other side of the street and saw the limousine leave Hobby Airport and go to downtown where he made a speech in Houston. And then and we saw them go by. We waved at them, but they had the top on the limousine, and it was dark glass, and we didn't ever see him. But I'd heard that they had a bubble top for that, and they just decided not to use it on the street on the day of the assassination, but that they had it there available. And so, like, who made the decision not to use it? But anyway, to get back to the main story, they left the next day for Fort Worth, and then spoke there in the morning at a breakfast, and then were coming. And then they flew into Love Field in Dallas, and got in this no bubble top limousine, and went down the parade route, which was down, I guess, Main Street or Commerce, whichever one of the streets they used, towards the book depository, and made the curve where they slowed down and everything, and then went under the what amounts to where the grassy knoll was, where the railroad tracks crossed over, an underpass, and then was going on to a noon luncheon, and that's when this all happened. But so then the next day, it was just awful, and then the next day, of course, they caught Oswald and put him in jail. And then it was Sunday morning, they were going to move him from his jail cell to another jail cell, or to another building where it was safer or more remote or something. I don't just know where they were moving him to. But that's when Oswald was shot by Jack Ruby. But going back a bit, I met Jack Ruby through...
Al Sharp?
No, through Tom Palmer.
Tom Palmer.
Because Al Sharp's up in Chicago now.
Oh, I'm sorry, sure.
Tom Palmer invited me to the Carousel Club, which was owned and run by Jack Ruby.
They're in Dallas.
Joint, but a very nice club, and they did have the exotic dancers and all. And so Tom was doing his funny act there, and it went very well. And he introduced me to Jack Ruby, and I thought nothing of it. I look good to meet you, Mr. Ruby, and you've got a very nice club or something like that. That was about all I ever said to him. And so, anyway, what happens on Saturday night, the AGVA representative goes around to all the strip clubs or strip joints and collects dues from all the exotic dancers, because they made up 90% of the membership. And they didn't pay their dues. And Tom, as the representative, had to go collect the dues or they'd be out of money. But they would have to pay up. They would get the money from being paid off on Saturday night. And so he was up till, 4 a.m. at various clubs collecting dues. And so they went to bed, at 4 or 5 in the morning, he and Gloria. And so they were sound asleep. And at 6 a.m., Thomas telling me the story just a couple of days later from when this all happened. And he said the phone rang, and it was Al Sharp on the phone. And he said, gee whiz, Al, I just got to sleep, and it's 6 a.m. Sunday morning. What's going on? He said, okay, wake up and listen to me. This is very, very important. I want you to get hold of Jack Ruby, whether it's at his club, at his home, whatever you have to do, keep trying until you get hold of Jack Ruby. And as soon as possible, tell him this, do not send the letter. He said, what letter are we talking about? He said, that's not important right now. Your job, if you want to keep your job, is to get hold of Jack Ruby and tell him as fast as possible, just do not send the letter. And Tom said, well, is this some sort of a code or something? He said, Al said to Tom, don't ask any more questions. What your job depends on it, my job depends on it. You get hold of Jack Ruby now, as soon as possible, until you find him, and simply tell him, do not send the letter. Have you got that? Do it. And he said, well, okay, I'll try. He said, don't try, just do it. And he was pretty adamant about that. And they hung up, and that was that. So Tom tried to call the club, Carousel Club. Well, nobody's there. It's locked up.
Right.
And no answer. So he tried to call his home, and there was no answer. And he said, well, maybe he's still sound asleep. I don't know. It's 6:30 now in the morning, Sunday morning. Al, I can't. I don't know where else to call. I guess I've got to give up for a while, and I'll try later in the day, but I don't know how to get hold of him now. And so they poured a cup of coffee, and were having coffee. He and Gloria were watching the TV, and watching the transfer of Oswald down that hallway in the jail, and then they see Jack Ruby walk out of the crowd and go bang. And then immediately they said, holy mackerel, that's what the letter was about, I guess. He wasn't supposed to do that. The word was to not do that. Something was planned and do not do it. And that's what Tom figured. That's what I figured.
Mm-hmm.
And so they decided that, well, Tom and I think Gloria both, or at least Tom did, went downtown, called the FBI and said, I've got some information that you possibly want, and I don't know whether to give it to you on the phone or what, but I'd like to come down and give it to somebody with the, in the FBI in person. They said, well, come on down. We need all the information we can get. So he went down and told this story, and then he said, okay, thank you, Mr. Palmer, for coming down and giving us the story. We've got the information. Now, listen to this. Don't call us again. If we need you, we'll call you. Do you understand that? He said, yeah, I guess I do. So they hung up, and that was the end of that, and they never were called. But two or three years later, they were called again, and they did ask Tom to come in and tell his story again. So 3 years later, when people didn't go along with the Warren Commission report, and they were still trying to find more information, they did get the information. So that information is in the FBI file somewhere, but you know we're never going to hear it. But so how to get out of this? So Al Sharpton, not Al Sharpton, different yeah. Al Sharp called again and told Tom not to worry about it. Don't pass on that story to anyone, because it was just simply about an exotic dancer that was going to sue AGFA for not getting paid from her bond that was up, that all the union bookers had to have up a bond, so in case they weren't paid by an agent, they could get the money. And she didn't get her money. They paid no attention to her, so she was going to sue and going to write a letter to the national office. And that was what they wanted her. Do not send the letter. Told Jack Ruby, do not send the letter, or something like that, you know. So that's what the letter was about. Well, Tom didn't believe it. I don't believe it to this day. Why was Al calling at 6 a.m. on that Sunday morning after the assassination to tell Tom to get hold of Jack Ruby, of all the people in the world, get hold of Jack Ruby and tell him, do not send the letter, and he'll understand.
Wow, yeah, because there are no coincidences, and that just seems to be too strange of a coincidence, certainly. So it was that the story that Al Sharp stuck with, I guess, and I wonder if the FBI ever contacted him and to give that story.
As far as I know, they didn't. I mean, if they did, I'll put it this way, I don't know if they did anything about it. But of all the subsequent stories about the assassination plot and everything, I've seen this story nowhere. So, as time went on, it just was kind of forgotten about.
Well, what do you think that Al may have been associated with? I mean, there have been all kinds of conspiracy theories of whether it was the CIA or whether it was the Cubans or whether it was the Mafia or something. And since this was a club with strippers, do you think it may have something to do with sort of underground?
Jack Ruby, they say, was connected, I guess, with the mob in Chicago. And so he was well known among the people up there in Chicago that were part of the Mafia, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever they said, if they were involved and they told Jack Ruby to do what you have to do, and then they decided they might get caught or something and decided to change their mind and did not want him to do it, that is just conjecture. And I don't have the answer. And in fact, you know, people decide whether there's a real heaven and we die and go there or there's not. That's a religious matter.
Mm-hmm.
That's up to everyone to decide. But I've always said that if there is a heaven and we do go there, I hope it's a place where I can ask a question and get an honest answer and know it's from God and whatever I hear is going to be correct. And one question would be, who really killed Kennedy and why? And then another experience I had was seeing flying saucers in Mexico, in Guanajuato, Mexico, and they flew right over me. And I would like to ask, what was it I saw? Were they flying manned flying objects from intelligent people, or what was it I saw? And millions of other Mexicans also saw and all reported the same thing. I'd like to know what they were, where they came from, who was behind it, and get an answer to that.
Right. Well, that may be a story for our later podcast sometimes, because I had an experience with a UFO whenever I was in high school, too. So it might be kind of an interesting trail to go down. But I wanted to also ask you about Noel Coward. Now, he was the president of the Texas Association of Magicians in 1980. Not to be confused with Noel Coward, who was the playwright, but this was the gentleman from Midlothian, Texas. You said he had a copy of the Magruder film?
I think his wife's name was Stella. And I think Noel and Stella lived in Midlothian, Texas, small town. I don't have a map in front of me, but I'm guessing 60 miles away southwest of Dallas, I think. And I went there and did a show, and it was quite probably the annual banquet of the Chamber of Commerce of Midlothian. And I think I spent the night with Noel and Stella in their home, and Noel had the local funeral parlor and cemetery there, and it was the mortician and the whole works. And so we got to talk about the Tom Palmer call and with Al Sharp and the assassination and everything. He said, well, I didn't know you were so interested in all that. I said, oh, yeah, I am. He said, well, coincidentally, the editor of our local paper is also interested, and he spent a lot of time and a lot of effort in trying to get information on this, and he has a copy of the Zapruder film. The Zapruder film, which you and everyone probably knows, that was showed the assassination as it took place.
Yeah, it was the clearest film apparently that was taken by an amateur photographer that was used in the Warren Report.
One generation down from the original Zapruder film, and this editor was able to get that made for him, and he had it. And he said, do you want to see it? And I said, well, sure. Well, he showed it to me, and then he showed me a little work that he'd done on the copy of it. But when I saw it, my jaw just dropped open, because you see the first shot hit Kennedy, and he slumps forward, and then the second shot apparently hits him, and he seemed to slump forward. And then that third shot hits him in the forehead, and his whole body is just blown backwards, just where it almost would break his neck. It forced him back so strongly. And apparently the top half of his head was shot off and went flying off to the rear, and they think that's what Jackie was trying to scramble onto the rear end of this limousine, this open limousine, to get the part that was blown off. You know, like if you lost a finger, you try to get the finger in and get it sewn back on or something.
Well, that's what I heard, that some of the Secret Service agents had said that he felt that she was trying to get some of the brain matter or something off of the trunk.
And so anyway, and he was the one, I think, trying to climb on and get on the back of the car and push her back down in the car and protect her, because they didn't know how many more shots were going to be fired and from where.
Right.
But they talked about the grassy knoll. That was directly in front of the car as it was speeding towards the underpass. That was called the underpass. And three major streets, Elm, Commerce, and Main Street, all converge together and go under the underpass together. And so he had turned, I think, off of Main, I think, onto
Commerce.
Over to Commerce, and then they made the bend at the school depository, and then that aimed back to the Main Street, and all three streets went under the underpass. I forget the name of the side street that ran right in front of the jail. And then right at the corner was the school book depository.
Well, my question would be, how did Noel Coward come across a first generation of a copy of this film?
Well, Noel didn't. It was the editor of the Midlothian newspaper.
I see. I apologize. Hope I understand.
He had the clout to get that and see it. And then he had that first generation film, or I guess you called it the second generation film. And he showed that to me. And then another little part of the story, he had put together the actual third shot and looped it to where you see the shot hit and knock his whole body backwards, and then it starts over and you see him slump forward. You mm-hmm. see him hit again and knocked him backwards, and he looped that, and I saw that loop four or five times. And at the same moment, on the air, you hear Dan Rather saying, and the third shot apparently hit him and knocked him forward. And at that moment, in this looped tape, you see him knocked backwards. And then you hear, knocked forward, boom, he goes back. Knocked forward, boom, he goes back. And you see that three or four times in repetition, and your jaw just drops open like, oh, my gosh. So Rather had to, either was told to say that, or for whatever reason he had, he kept saying, and the third shot also knocked him forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a it was such a lie, and I think Dan Rather had to know that. I mean, Dan Rather probably saw the film. But then from then on, when they show the film and all these different things on TV, well, it's fuzzy, it's grainy, and you never see the full sequence clearly of the three shots. And I don't think any of them ever showed his body being knocked backwards.
Hmm.
And I don't recall seeing it. Maybe somewhere somebody has that. But I did see it clearly. And so nobody can convince me that that third shot that hit him caused a knee-jerk type reaction that actually caused him to go forward. But
well, let me go back just a step for a minute, because I know that you were friends with Al Sharpe and you had visited with him, I'm sure, after that time. Did you ever approach him or ask him about what his thoughts were?
Yeah, and he repeated that
same story. Yeah.
That it was just, there's nothing to it. It was just a nasty letter that...
from one of the dancers.
Right, on behalf or against this exotic dancer that was going to send her letter to the National AGVA office, which I assume was in Chicago, but it might have been in New York, the national office. In fact, I think maybe it was in New York. And they didn't want Jack Ruby to send that letter. But on Sunday morning at 6 a.m., it was that important to wake up Tom that had just gotten to sleep and make such an adamant thing about get hold of him now, as soon as possible. Your job and my job depend on it. Just do it. Don't ask questions. Just do it. And
there was no repercussion, I assume, that since he was supposed, he said your job depends on it, and obviously he didn't get to him in time, so he must have kept his job.
By then it was done, and either the FBI didn't want to talk to it. It's like the FBI didn't want this information.
Well, see, my thought would be that if he was not told or not supposed to reach him to say don't deliver the letter, that it must have been delivered anyhow. The person must have gotten it. I just wonder if there was a lawsuit that was followed, you know, to follow up on that.
Not that I know of. In other words, that's about the total amount of information I got from Tom Palmer, and I trust he told me the truth because Tom was a good friend.
Another connection that magic or magicians have with this is Johnny Sissom. Johnny was a magician who was well known, the Texas Association magician, who lives in Dallas,
yeah.
And has since passed. But he had the JFK Museum right there on Dealey Plaza. Did you know much about that or him?
No, well, I knew Johnny Sissom really well, and he was trying to make a living kind of off of his little museum there. And it was a tourist attraction. People did want to come from all over. When they went to Dallas, they wanted to go see Dealey Plaza and see where the jail was, see where the book depository was. And I think they had some artifacts, like a statue or a plaque or something out there now. But he had this museum, and I don't know what all he sold there. Maybe a book or I just don't know what he sold there. But
yeah.
He had some artifacts there. And but a lot of people that were in Dealey Plaza that saw what went on and had their stories, a lot of them all had mysterious deaths shortly thereafter.
I've heard that story, too. That's kind of interesting.
Like about 15 different people just slowly died from mysterious circumstances.
Yeah, it wasn't natural causes.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of stuff that's still unknown, and they are holding back some of it till some 50 years, well, more than 50 years later, like, because now it's 50 years later.
That's right.
I think there's going to stuff come out. And there was talk that LBJ was involved, and Castro was involved, and the mafia was involved. And I don't know who was connected or who was responsible for all this. But I'm pretty convinced that Oswald was a patsy and did fire the rifle and probably did fire three shots, and that two of which may have hit Kennedy, and he was bent on killing him. I believe probably all that, and then I think he probably killed Officer Tippett, you know, who was trying to catch him before he, and then he was murdered outside on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And got out of his patrol car and told him to put your hands in sight and come over here now. I mean, like right now. And that's when apparently Oswald took out his pistol and shot three or four times and killed Officer Tippett. And then very quickly went into the movie house, which was the Texas Theater. And later I did a show in the Texas Theater, and I said, oh my gosh, this is where they apprehended Oswald, you know.
Mm-hmm. Were you doing your ladder levitation back then?
No, I that was before I had the ladder levitation.
Yeah.
I was still working out of Houston by then, but it was before the ladder levitation.
Yeah.
But no, I didn't do that trick there.
Well, one thing, it sounds like that we know for sure that it was not a conspiracy by magicians.
Well, I'm sure of that. Yeah. Although I haven't checked with Valentino.
And the masked magician, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, Walter, thank you very much. Fascinating.
Of course, Valentino had nothing to do or knew anything about this.
Wasn't even born back then, right.
That's probably right. I'm sure that's right.
But,
and I still miss old Tom. He was a good buddy and good friend, and I miss Gloria as well. And Ralph Markham, they're all gone now.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen some pictures of Tom Palmer's act and how funny that it was. And yeah, it was very good. And I'm glad that some of those ideas have found their way maybe into Johnny Thompson's act. And I'm sure he was good friends, you know, having lived in Chicago then as well. I'm sure we're very close friends.
Oh, yeah. And Tom was very helpful and said, sure, take the idea and run with it. I don't do the act anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I really tried to talk Tom into saying you got hold of something special here, but he just would not take what small advice that was, and he just dropped the act, and that was the end of it.
Well, when he took on the new character of Tony Andruzzi, he went off on a completely different tangent, you know, of doing the bizarre type of in witchcraft, and I think he had a different belief system or something from what I've read. Well, Walter, again, I want to thank you very much for joining us and kind of giving us that background, so this way we then now have it to...
Well, my pleasure.
Yes.
I guess I'm getting a call from Joe Stevens now. You're coming in. So
okay.
I'll switch there.
All right.
Okay?
Thanks again, Walter.
Great talk.
We'll see you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Adios.
Now.
Bye.
And so there we have Walter Blaney giving us a little bit of insight in the background from his perspective of what he knows or has heard firsthand and seen regarding the assassination of John F. Kennedy back in 1963. So for now, the magic word, and that was Walter Blaney, Scotty out.